Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And it appears that the P5 plus one talks in Geneva came very close to making a deal. That was the rumor. And at the last minute, they broke down, even though they're resuming in 10 days' time. And in Iran, what one hears that they're blaming the French, and apparently it was the French position insisting on more transparency to do with the nuclear power reactor. I believe that's the one that the Russians have built. Is it? Is that the one that they're concerned about, the plutonium coming out of that reactor?
That's correct. But also, it's not just in Iran. I think in England and in the United States also, they are blaming the French. And maybe blame is not the right word, but the reality is that the P5 plus one is supposed to be one block and to be negotiating from one position with Iran. And whether it's been on imposition of sanctions or demands from Iran in the past, P5 plus one has largely spoken with one voice. In Geneva, this broke down. In other words, there were different positions within P5 plus one, and the French position and the French demands were not the same ones as either the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, or Russia's. So this is largely a problem within P5 plus one and its structure, rather than a problem with Iran. Had the French not showed up in Geneva at all, more than likely there would have been a deal.
So what explains France's role? They haven't taken a lead role, as far as I know, in throughout these talks. And why do they have these particular objections to the idea, which is fairly fundamental with the kind of reactor that the Russians are building? And I believe the Russians always have offered the idea that they would redo the reprocessing themselves. I don't know whether that's still on the table, but this seems to be coming rather late in the day. Everybody's aware that spent fuel rods can be converted into plutonium.
Well, that's exactly it. In other words, that the P5 plus one, one would have assumed, would have had a conversation among themselves before going to Geneva in terms of what they're willing to accept and not accept and to have a uniform position with Iran. But this is a failure on the part of P5 plus one, that you go into negotiations, you do negotiations for 2 days, and then at the last minute, the French foreign minister arrives and says, well, this is not good enough for me and my government. Now, you know, the French also did take a position that was harsher than the United States in 2009 when President Sarkozy was in power and they were to the right of the United States. And they demanded that the U.S. not recognize at all the right to enrich, and what they were demanding at that time, zero enrichment. And, you know, the reason why France may have taken the position does not have to do with the specifics of this particular reactor. It has to do more with the posture that they have vis-a-vis Iran, which at this point in time is closer to the Israeli position and farther away from the United States position, namely, in their view, the bar for a first step deal is higher than that I think the United States and the other members of P5 plus one were willing to accept. Now, that might have to do with France wanting to play a particularly pivotal role. Some have argued it has to do with the fact that the French think once European sanctions are lifted, they cannot be reimposed as easily as in the United States. It might have to also do that they just simply don't share the U.S. optimism about these talks, and they are more sensitive to the views of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel, all of whom have been opposed to any kind of an interim deal with Iran.
Now, would that have anything to do with Syria, since they're all on the same page in Syria?
No, I don't think it has to do with Syria at all. I mean, in a larger way, France is trying to navigate a foreign policy position for itself. President Hollande wants to be cooperative with the United States, but at the same time does not want to be seen as a stooge of the United States. And therefore, the French have been periodically breaking with the United States at high levels in order to assert that they have an independent position and they're not following the U.S. lead. And clearly, their actions in Geneva would fall under that. And, you know, sometimes there is just petty ego of countries. I mean, France has now emerged as a world power that could hold up these most sensitive negotiations and demand that its particular, conditionalities be satisfied before a deal goes forward. In other words, by holding a veto, France is asserting its own unique importance here.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival, and Democracy in Iran between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So we know that France's foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, has been in touch with Netanyahu, apparently. Netanyahu's quite relieved. We just spoke with a journalist in Israel about that. What about, though, the Iranian what do they put on the table? If this deal, if everybody had agreed about the French on this deal, then the idea that Rouhani had to go back and consult with the supreme leader, and that's why they're going to come back in 10 days, that doesn't wash, right? In other words, Iran was ready to deal, and France torpedoed it.
Well, we don't know what the elements of the deal were in their totality. In other words, what is it that Iran exactly agreed to before the French veto? And what is it that the P5+1 agreed to give Iran exactly also in exchange for Iranian concessions? So we don't know exactly what the terms of a deal were. And therefore, it's very clear that, you know, the negotiations were prolonged in order to arrive at something that both sides would be willing to live with as a first agreement between them that would then, you know, be a basis for subsequent negotiations going forward. Now, at the last minute, you change the terms of a deal, then the other side basically will also demand other things or will basically say, well, this is not what we agreed on for the past 2 days. You're reopening the negotiations now, and we can reopen the negotiations on the last hour of the third day, and we may as well adjourn. We need to go home. You need to go home. P5+1 may actually use these 10 days to get their ducks in a row. And in Iran, you know, the Zarif can consult with the president, the supreme leader, about what their negotiation strategy ought to be. I think nobody, neither the United States nor the Iranians, had anticipated a French or any other country's curveball at the 11th hour. So they were obviously working in the direction of arriving at a deal. And they thought that, you know, they were narrowing the differences. But a sudden change in demand for terms basically reopens the discussion altogether.
Well, obviously there's an awful lot at stake for Iran. And it's always been very difficult to understand why it is that Iran feels so strongly about its right to enrich, given the enormous price that the country's paying, and the fact that the P5+1 represents China, Russia, Germany, France, England, and the United States is most of the world powers that seem to be united, except for this recent...
I don't think so. I don't think they're united on the right to enrichment part.
Sure, that's why the talks broke down. But prior to that, in other words, What is the explanation? Is this purely pride that's at stake here?
Well, pride is a big part of it. Within Iran, the government has never claimed that this is for weapons use, even though we may suspect very strongly that they do have a nuclear weapon program in mind. But the population sees this as a national asset, sees this as advancement of technology. They believe the country has invested massively in it, that it puts Iran in a very different league, industrially, politically, strategically, and that the West ultimately is not reconciled to allowing Iran to have this. So you know, the Iranian public is not opposed to nuclear technology, is not opposed to nuclear reactors, is not opposed to enrichment. They may be open to not having weaponization, but clearly they're not reconciled to being told that you cannot enrich. And the West, I don't think over the years, has really made a case to the Iranian public why they shouldn't have the right to enrich, other than trying to punish them into submission. And I think the Iranian public is ready to pay a price for this. We don't know how much of a price they would pay, but it's very difficult to sort of dictate from the outside to a public in another country about their priorities. So I think we're not on a very solid ground thinking that we can sway a vast amount of public opinion in Iran with threat of economic hardship. And I think given that now you have a different face on top in Iran, a government that's been more willing to reach out to the West and has done the right things, I think it's now even more difficult to argue to the Iranian public that they are entirely in default in this impasse, and why can't there be a deal that both sides would be able to abide by and would put the negotiations in a new phase?
But is that not to say, Vali Nasser, that the Iranian people are enduring hardships, their economies in tatters, $50 billion of their money is blocked and frozen in foreign accounts. They can't sell their oil. It would seem to me that the Iranian people must know they're paying a high price, and they've known this for some time. And the assumption is that that's one of the reasons why this more flexible approach on the part of the Iranian government manifested itself.
That's correct. I think you're absolutely right. But that does not mean that they're ready to completely surrender. And ultimately, the question is, what do they get in exchange for giving up various parts of this program or the program in its entirety? That has never been made clear to the Iranian public. In all of the Western world's pronouncements, that what is it? We all know exactly what the West is asking of Iran in great detail, but we really don't know what is it that they will get in great detail. And therefore, there's a lot of suspicion on that side as well, just like there's a lot of suspicion on this side about the fact that Iran may not be a honest broker, and if you cut a deal, they may cheat. I think on that side, there's also that same perception that Iran is being asked to give these things up, but in the end, once they give up the nuclear program, then the West is going to still hold on to the sanctions for Iran's support of terrorism and Hezbollah and Hamas, and then once Iran gave those up, then it's going to be human rights. And I think the Supreme Leader is quite convinced that the West is not after Iran's nuclear program, that the West is after regime change. And that suspicion does not really augur well for smooth negotiations.
Well, it's also more than a suspicion, isn't it? It's been pretty evident that there's been talk of regime change and bills have been passed in the Congress to that effect. But when Rouhani, the new leader, who appears to be a different face on that regime, told the Iranian parliament that his negotiations, that the negotiations with the big powers, that Iran had said, we will not answer to any threat, sanction, humiliation, or discrimination. Now, one of the terms of discrimination, I was pretty shocked by Wendy Sherman, the chief U.S. negotiator in the P5+1, her remark that deception is in the Iranian DNA.
Well, deception is in the DNA of every diplomat. I mean, you know, you do make you do bluff, you do try to wrongfoot your interlocutor. You try to get a better deal for yourself than everybody else, and you know that's no different than dealing with Russians, than dealing with Chinese. And their perception of us is the same as well. I think, you know, this kind of a rhetoric, you know, serves domestic political consumption, but it doesn't necessarily really reflect the way in which the world works. And ultimately, you want to get a signature on a piece of paper, and like any deal, a business deal, a political deal, a diplomatic deal, regardless of the virtue of each side, they will try to maximize gains to themselves, get as much as they can, and give up as little as they can. And you know, the mutual suspicion on both sides here feeds onto this. And in reality, there is no real strong record for the international community dismantling sanctions against any government without that government being toppled altogether. So, you know, sanctions against Iraq were removed after Saddam fell. Sanctions, in many cases, are removed only after the government goes. So similarly, there's a strong record that countries that have weapons of mass destruction and have invested massively in it are going to try to hold on to it as best as they can, and they're not evidence of a great cases, the difficult cases that countries have voluntarily given these up. So you know, Iran in many ways is a test case. Largely because we're trying to arrive at a deal where both sides have very, very deep suspicions, and the positions of both sides really runs against historical evidence that either the United States would ever remove sanctions on this regime in Iran, even if it signed on to a nuclear deal, or that Iran would really, truly give up its nuclear ambitions while this regime is still in power in Iran.
Well, but are we deluded then in thinking that this regime is not popular in its own inside Iran? We did see the Green Movement. I don't know how much that represents the majority of the population. It does seem that there's a fairly evident split between the city dwellers, the intellectuals, the women on the one side, and the rural poor who support the regime on the other. And it's highly militarized and with an active secret police, religious-based, what would you call the Basij militia? There's no equivalent.
Well, you know, there's two things to observe here. One is that the regime is unpopular, but the nuclear program is popular. Mm-hmm. And we seem to conflate these two things together. Just because people dislike the regime does not mean that they're going to take the side of the United States on the nuclear issue. And in fact, I think that the nuclear issue is the one issue where this unpopular regime is closest to its populace. Secondly, I would say that, you know, the 2009 uprising brought together many diverse elements of Iranian society, which is people who are completely against this regime, together with people who are not opposed to the regime but were opposed to President Ahmadinejad, all of them in one banner. Now you have a government in Iran that actually splits some of these factions away from one another. So there are still people in Iran who are completely opposed to this regime. But many of those people who are more in the middle, meaning they're not necessarily opposed to the regime, but they didn't like Ahmadinejad, now they like Rouhani, and they may not be necessarily in the same camp anymore as those who are completely opposed to the regime. This picture may change going forward. Rouhani could, you know, lose its popularity. But, you know, in some ways, it's not that different from the United States, where you build constituencies, if you would. And so at moments of election, you can have very disparate constituencies of people come together and then break up at different points. We really don't have a good gauge of micromanaging or even understanding the political coalitions and the broad political mood in Iran. And we're not able to take polls. We really don't have representation. We get anecdotal information from Tehran and the large cities. But what is clearly evident is that the Iranian government is not behaving as if it's really worried about another uprising.
Well, just in closing, Vali Nasser, though, does that mean that if the United States and other Western countries, and obviously Israel too, wants regime change, that they couldn't have chosen the worse issue than the nuclear one? I mean, if you want to split that regime from its people who don't like it, why go to the mat over a nuclear program when there are many other reasons to go to the mat that would be much would gain the sympathy of the Iranian people? I just don't get that strategy.
No, you're absolutely correct. In a sense, there is a confusion in our policy, which is completely focused on the nuclear program. Most of the sanctions are about nuclear program. The negotiations about nuclear program. But the problem that the Iranian public have with their own regime is over human rights issues. And those issues are not the issues that the United States and the P5 plus one have picked up as banner policies vis-a-vis Iran and are not championing those. So essentially, if Iran were to arrive at a negotiated settlement over its nuclear program, even as fantastic as that idea might seem, it sounds like then, you know, the pressure will be off and the regime would be able to continue in place for however long it can maintain power within Iran. I think it would have been a very different scenario if the United States and the major powers had put all of their emphasis on governance, democracy, and human rights in Iran. And that would have elicited a very different kind of a reaction from the Iranian public.
Well, Vali Nasser, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you. Good speaking with you.
Good to speak to you. Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins University's School of International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we will be back and go to Warsaw, Poland to speak about the UN climate talks underway there.